My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. Our next guest is a former army officer who specialised in nuclear, biological and chemical warfare. These skills found him working in areas such as Kabul, Basra and searching for weapons of mass destruction in Baghdad. He now runs a charity that uses motorsport to aid rehabilitation and long-term recovery. Episode 17, James Cameron. This is Declassified. James, you was born in 1973 in Leeds. What was childhood like in and around that time?
I think I had a really lovely childhood. I was sort of middle-class lad, born in the outskirts of Leeds, and a Leeds grammar school boy, and really actually a very sort of happy family upbringing. I was lucky.
Why? Because in 1995, you then joined the Royal Tank Regiment, went off to Sandhurst. Was it always on the cards?
Yeah, I loved scouts and sort of the adventure and all of those bits and pieces. And as soon as I could, I joined the cadet force at school. And I had, dragging things out of people. I had a brush with the Royal Air Force. I actually did a flying scholarship, and was debating going off to Cranwell, but a friend of mine invited out me out on a weekend out with the army cadets, and that was it. I think age 16 or 17, I knew that I wanted to join the army, and I knew that I wanted to go and do that. So after university, at the 1995, I turned up to Sandhurst with a view to joining the Royal Tank Regiment.
And was it because the uni thing, like UOTC, it was just a natural progression then to go to Sandhurst?
Yeah, no, I always go to Sandhurst. The only thing that was a question mark over probably was university, which kind of a necessary evil. I don't think I was very focused at university. In fact, it took me 4 years to get a 3-year degree. Largely because I was more engaged in doing different things, whether it was rallying in Kenya when I should have been in exams, or just generally gallivanting about the place. I found the university library in my third year at Newcastle, and that probably sums up my academic career. I was much more focused on doing other stuff. And I did officer training corps throughout university as well, so sort of thrown myself into that. And turning up at Sandhurst was really the only place where I really wanted to be. That was where I was heading.
What was you like then? Do you enjoy it?
I think I'm one of sort of life's enthusiasts, so I kind of throw myself at stuff. I think age 21, 22, you're quite sheltered as well. I think as a young officer, I was probably a bit of a nightmare. In fact, there's no probably about it. I think I was a bit of a nightmare as a young officer. And you look back on that and sort of wince slightly when you just...
What, at Sandhurst or...?
No, not particularly, but just, bouncing out to Germany with all the sort of freedoms of, that kind of brought. It was a lot of fun, I had a great time. I sort of took what I did seriously, but I think you're quite immature at that age.
So we touched on Germany then. You went out to Paderborn end of 2006 after you passed out from Sandhurst.
'96.
I know Paderborn really well, and there's loads of opportunity out there, and you went off to like Sandhurst, you went off to Cyprus and Poland and Canada. Was life good then as a junior officer?
Yeah, very much so. It was great, really, sort of, end of the Cold War kind of time. You're sort of running into people who, we were chatting about this yesterday, who had spent whole careers, building up their tax-free car allowance in between them and their wives, rotating things every 6 months. People were were living quite well. There was Northern Ireland in the background of things that were running. And sort of around that time, I had peers who were off to Kosovo and Bosnia, but I'd sort of missed out on that. Yeah, I mean, I loved my time on tanks. I really, really enjoyed that. That was huge amounts of fun. And I think as a young officer, if you sort of, you know, met me then, I would have probably been boasting about, you know, the size of a tank and, you know, what it could do. And as a young captain, I'd probably be boasting about sort of, you know, exercise budgets and the amount of influence you can have over, you know, even some NATO stuff when you're in the right, sort of right thing. But you look back on it, really, and I realise actually the common thread and the thing that really drew me to it was just the incredible privilege that it is to work with Her Majesty's soldiers. You know, I think that was that throughout has been the common thread that has really sort of brought joy to my career. It's been fantastic.
Because I'm looking at that. I'm just looking at my notes now, and like I said before, Cyprus, Poland, especially Poland and Canada, for the Royal Tank Regiment. What are you actually doing in those places?
So you're exercising your role in proper full armoured warfare. So, you know, you start off doing single tank stuff, being able to operate, you know, 65 tonnes of armour and the crew. And then it builds up through troop level, you know, sort of three tank small group activity, which is what you're in charge of as a young second lieutenant or a lieutenant. All the way up to squadron, battalion, and, you know, sort of Poland is exercising up to brigade size interaction. So big bits of real estate covering large bits of ground. And, you know, I mean, I love the outdoors, and I've always been pretty useful. I'm probably a weird officer because I'm all right with a map. I can generally be trusted to find my arse with both hands. So, just developing that sort of spatial awareness of where you are, what's happening on the battlefield, where people are, and how you can maneuver in order to have effect. Those are the only chances. You know, Salisbury Plain is fantastic, and you go out on it and it just feels huge, but in armour it's not massive. You know, there's bits where you can spread out as a troop, there's, you know, perhaps a run where as a squadron you might be able to get a go, but once you've done it, you know it. You know, for the guys who tread the plane going backwards and forwards, you know, it's backco in those days, but you know, where you had the same backco sheet on exercising, there were people who didn't need to get the backco decoder out to work out the grid they were being told to go to.
What does that mean? Like, so what does backco mean?
Backco was a code system so that you could send simple information in number and letter form over the radio, and experienced operators would be able to do
decode it.
Yeah, decode it quickly, and you had effectively a sheet which would then unlock line by line.
So there was a lot of learning going on in those really valuable stuff in Poland and Canada, because they're such big areas. You in tanks and the bare bones of it. Challenger, is that right?
Challenger back in those days,
and just really layman's terms, a tank with a big gun on it.
Yeah, no, I mean, tank tends to get used for, you know, it makes tankies twitch when you see scimitars and things, or smaller recce vehicles or artillery pieces being referred to as tanks, you know, and we'll just start to twitch a little bit. A main battle tank is 65 tons. It's a proper piece of kit, and its job is to bring direct fire on the enemy, you know, line of sight stuff and maneuver and ultimately to kill other tanks. It was a fantastic grounding back then in stuff that I came back to revisit later in my career. But the other thing I was kind of learning about as well was how you could apply principles to things and give people them the freedom of operation, where you would tell them what you wanted to achieve, what success looked like, and you gave them the reason for why you were doing it, but then gave them the freedom to innovate in order to be able to get to that goal, which is mission command. And you really feel that, particularly out in Batters, where you've got sort of freedom of manoeuvre and things like that. In Canada, this incredible training area, you know, that's the size of North Wales, where you can properly spread out, get lost, disappear off the edge of the map, going the wrong way. But the subunits that really succeed are working intuitively, where they trust people, they understand that they can, they know intuitively how those around them are going to work, and it's amazing when it works. It's incredible.
So I mean, we go through training there and honing skills as such. You ended up at the Army Foundation College. Not ended up, but you went from Paderborn to the Army Foundation College. Did a bit of training the recruits there. 2000, you ended up, and I remember it kind of happening. I think almost, you know, just being this like, what is this all about? But correct me if I'm wrong, so the first Royal Tank Regiment became the Joint NBC Regiment, so the Joint Nuclear, Biological and Chemical.
Yeah, it did. And I was at Harrogate, so I missed. I wasn't at regimental duty when that was announced. And I missed the move from Germany back to the UK that kind of brought, but it caused some angst, it really did. I mean, NBC, Michael, you know, you and I both know, it was, good God, that was the terrible thing that you had to do towards the end of exercises. You'd get the NBC phase out of the way and we'd all wear our face welly for
gas mask,
20 minutes, and then you'd get to start packing up and going home. It was not the most not what I'd really seen myself doing in my military career, but it was I went back to the regiment as a captain, so I'd
2000
I'd just gone back on promotion and was going back as a squadron second in command at that point, but I'd argued the case that I didn't understand the core job of what was happening and didn't want to go into a squadron headquarters when I didn't understand the job that the troops were doing. Unfortunately, at that time they were short of troop leaders, so I was trained up in order to go out to Iraq, Kuwait, on the Iraqi border, where we were manning biological detection systems in the deserts at that time.
In 2000?
Yeah. And this was countering, you know, a perceived threat from Iraq that of biological weapons release. So we had guys out in the desert on the Iraqi border on an enduring basis. That was an enduring operation. And for me, I'd at university, you know, despite having not tried very hard, some of it had obviously gone in. I'd done environmental sciences, which I think the main reason why I'd done it was because there were lots of girls on that course.
Well,
which seemed like a good a reason as any. But it meant that when I was at Porton Down getting trained up on this biological detection system, I understood some of the terminology that the scientists were using. And because of that, because, you know, you've got a little bit of knowledge, then you're the guy then who ends up at the forefront of things when we're asked to do new stuff. And it began a sort of really interesting phase in my career that I really hadn't expected, and went and did all sorts of interesting and exciting force development stuff that saw us go, you know, we chased foot and mouth across the UK in order to see whether the pyres that they were building out of the corpses of animals when they were burning them, these funeral pyres, whether that was actually spreading things downwind. And when September the 11th happened, we were at the front end of the British troops that went into Afghanistan, into Kabul, in a new capability, in a light role carrying kit that no one had sort of seen before, in order to go into the centre of Afghanistan in order to go and look for and to do force protection role in order to protect people against chemical, biological and radiological and nuclear stuff, which I think a few years before I would have found extraordinary. At the time it was absolutely fantastic. We were getting to do some really cool stuff and working with some really interesting people.
So I find it fascinating, this bit. So there's so many little offshoots going on and you know little cogs turning. September the 11th happened. We then rolled into Afghanistan 2001.
Yeah.
You was part of a small team, was you? How many?
It was a 8-man team.
Okay, really small.
Yeah, no.
Was you leading that team?
Yeah, I mean, I actually went in early. The lads got held up. So, I mean, it was an extraordinary time. We, you know, we're on the back of the Cold War and we're airlifting Brits into the centre of Afghanistan in Russian ex-military aircraft. Right. You know, we were flying our fuel in by Ilyushin 76. Our Land Rovers came in, so the kit, and there was only wheeled stuff, came in by Antonov, you know, flown into Kabul, which sits in a bowl, and the anti-aircraft threat was very high at the time we came in. So that was an exciting ride in out of Oman, where they'd put you for acclimatization. So you're in 30-odd degrees in the Omani desert in a non-air-conditioned tent wearing desert combats. And I just remember the Hercules ride goes in, and the lights went out in the aircraft. You sat on your body armor. It all suddenly seems a bit serious with your kit. And they tell you when the back ramp goes down, you go out of the back ramp and then you run towards the light, just head towards the light. And you run, and the Hercules spirals into Kabul, the airfield. It was surrounded by minefields, so there was, you know, just uncleared. Mm. You know, Charlie and his boys had an absolute field day with mine clearance around that place, you know, and they still pick bits of it. The back ramp went down, and you go down the back ramp thinking we're going to be heading for this light, and it was minus 14 when you went down the ramp, and I nearly turned around and went back into the aircraft. I'm like, what's all this about? This is wrong. So yeah, Afghanistan was incredible at that time.
What was you finding, or was you finding anything? Was there out in, and was you spreading out past the city, or was you?
Yeah, so we're reoccupying things like the British Embassy. You know, they're finding a location for the what became ISAF headquarters to go into, establishing the APOD, the airport, getting that up and running.
But
again,
what was
so
you
stuff,
doing?
Things can come out
in your role there.
Helping out with the clearance of some bits and pieces. Now that there's also huge amounts of intelligence about what was in Kabul at that time, and we had a tick list of things, concerns that we were literally going through. So the extraordinary thing is, sort of, we went there looking for some, you know, we went there looking for some fairly scary stuff, and everything we looked for we found. So there was a anthrax production facility on the outskirts of. On the outskirts of Kabul, which was producing veterinary vaccines. Mm. So in order to, you know, in order to protect you against a virus, you will literally grow something which is closely related to it in order to inoculate against it. Yeah. And so there was something which, you know, we had gone in prepared lots of aerial photographs of, some ground intelligence, some signals intercepts and all the rest of it. But they thought this place was deserted. It was interesting when we went bouncing along in order to go and secure this compound on the edge of town, these buildings, and the stuff that was going on in there. We'd had it under observation for a week beforehand, and sort of all was quiet apart from, you know, just local kids sort of within the compound and the odd dog. And turned up with full kit in order to be able to go into this building, and were greeted by a cheerful bunch of Afghan scientists. Uh-huh. Who it was their first day back at work, that they determined that it was safe enough for them to come back out of their homes and go back to work because the security situation had changed. And, you know, you're turning up in full three Romeo, so you're wearing the works, you know, a full NBC suit, all the rest of it, with the door then gets opened on the other side by a cheerful looking elderly Afghan bloke in a white coat, which was quite interesting. So
they weren't weaponizing it, though? They were using it for...
No, there was no, and this thing was entirely peaceful process, but they'd been under Taliban control for some time.
Yeah,
and you could see where the different warring factions, and whether it's Taliban or whether it's somebody else, it's always hard to determine, had tried to, either through ignorance or through an attempt to do something nefarious, had tried to have a go at things. So we spent a lot of time with what was a medical radiological source, a big gamma emitter, which is properly lethal, which was in the remnants of the Kabul hospital. The Russians used to use big gamma emitters to do radiotherapy for all sorts of different conditions. And would use large radioactive sources in order to be able to do it. And some of the locals and some of the military types had quite a good go at removing this thing. And we knew that firsthand because of the human remains that were around it, where people had sort of gone. Now, that's an interesting task for you know, sort of young captain with a team of, I mean, just fantastic senior NCOs, you know, just some really good quality blokes, figuring out, right, how can we make sense of this? How can we make something safe? And we achieved it. And, you know, I had a rather interesting sort of 10-day period with, I think, my metal mug down the front of my trousers most of the days. But I managed
to.
And
what was it used for again?
Radiotherapy. So,
and they tried nicking it to...
Yeah, for whatever, you know, whether it even just as a scrap value, people would just try and sort of get into all sorts of things and just don't know what they're dealing with. But, I mean, the very real fear is that had that been successful, then the opportunity to use that as a dirty bomb, to use it for malevolent intent would be...
Yeah, I mean...
It would be incredibly effective.
You talked about fear there and intent and not quite, well, having this... kind of dangerous subject substance and using it, which kind of leads us on to 2002 2003. You was in let's just say Iraq. You crossed the border as part of this,
yeah,
the NBC stuff. You pushed on into Basra. You ended up in Baghdad.
Yeah,
and it's the Baghdad,
yeah,
time, if we can and you can be as loose as with this one. I know there's a lot of kind of...
Yeah, no, I mean, those are interesting times. So, and I think history's going to look back on that period with a different lens to how a lot of people had looked at it at the time.
Because you was part of the team that was trying to look for weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, so I was originally at regimental duty, so I'd sort of bounced across the border when we went through actually with the U.S. Marine Corps breaching the border into Iraq, and then up as far as Basra, where the regiment remained. But I went off with a small team up to Baghdad and went into Baghdad with the Americans, and was I ended up as chief of staff to the British deputy commander of the Iraq Survey Group, which was the organization that was looking for the WMDs. And that was, yeah, just an extraordinary time. Incredibly interesting, incredibly busy, but also, but not without its challenges. You know, Dr. David Kelly's story was really well documented. You know, and I was the guy who was showing him around Baghdad and Qatar as well, the headquarters that had been established there. And going through and discussing evidence with him when, you know, he was the guy who was, you know, I think many thought hung out to dry.
Who was he?
With a parliamentary committee. So he was a senior government scientist and something of a living national treasure in terms of just an extraordinary guy who had an incredible scientific background, you know, sort of worked at Porton Down, and he'd been responsible for... unraveling some of the Soviet infrastructure of weapons of mass destruction and the challenge inspections which had gone on over those times. You know, he'd been very much part of that, and he just had an incredible encyclopedic knowledge of his subject, and it was extraordinary. And the other thing that was extraordinary for me is, you know, my blokes kind of recognised, you know, hadn't particularly seen much of the history of kind of what he'd done, but just recognised that this guy was something quite special, and he had quite an impact on them. And then it was extraordinary when, you know, sort of 10 days later we were watching the news in order to find out that he died, you know, he'd committed suicide back in the UK following a roasting live on television, I think by a committee over the dossier and the contents of the dossier and whether... because he'd expressed an opinion through a journalist, and then he was the one who was kind of wheeled out for that.
But, and you was with him before that, you know?
Yeah, literally days before. Absolutely, in Iraq, in Baghdad.
And for your, you know, what you was doing out there, you were genuine. It was all genuine. You was looking for this stuff. Did you find anything?
Yeah, no. There was all sorts of stuff that was found, but it was. You know, history has demonstrated it was a long way away from what was
in the brochure.
Yeah, yeah, what it said on the tin, which was, you know, weaponized stuff, ready to go, all the rest of it. And we, you know, they absolutely found that people had kept strains of biological things, but it's quite some way, you know, having a strain of something biological to having a weaponized thing which is ready to go, deployable, all the rest of it, that that could be instantly used against someone. I think we're sort of approaching the period where that's going to properly get pulled apart, and it's going to be interesting, I think, to see some of the conclusions which came out of it. It was a culmination for me of a sort of just a fascinating period of getting to work with some really interesting different agencies, people, both military and sort of other departments, which then continued. I mean, and I was 30 years old, so in order to go in as chief of staff, they promoted me in the field. So I was an acting major, which was great. You know, I mean, it did my, you know, it's done my pension forecast no harm anyway.
an early promotion in the field. So by the time we'll jump now. So you came back, got married, and you was off doing other bits and pieces in between.
Yeah.
You know, 2003. I'll land us in 2009. You went to the Second Royal Tank Regiment, and you was in a role where kind of brings us into the Afghan period again, but more the war fighting stuff, where you was part of the development and the acquisition, where you was taking, or you was removing one vehicle and implementing another vehicle. Just can you like talk about that?
Sure. Well, then some of your previous guests have talked about some of the armour that was used in Afghanistan, whether it was Warrior, you know, or Viking. And Viking was originally derived from a vehicle which was used in the Arctic, a sort of two-box, very high-mobility vehicle, tracked. So it's got rubber tracks underneath. It's articulated in between the two, and that's how it steers, which was used an awful lot in the Arctic by the likes of the Royal Marines, and armoured sufficiently to be able to keep the cold, snow, and bird shit out, but not particularly good against IEDs and things like that, particularly from below. So that vehicle had been developed, and they put bar armour on it. They'd changed various bits and pieces about it. It was fantastic in, because you're not going to use main armour in the Helmand River Valley.
So you're not going to use your tanks?
Absolutely. Yeah. They, you know, those are way, where you're dealing with a lightweight enemy that's dapping about the place with flip-flops, frankly, you need something with a door on the side where you can open, get out, and deal with someone eye to eye, not something that's got 120mm main armament on top. It's just not relevant for that theatre. And Viking had presented a great solution because it's incredible levels of mobility, low ground pressure, so it's soft across the ground, and presented lots of fantastic things with a payload in the back. You put lads in the back of it, you can do anything. But Viking, and my regiment had seen on previous tours, was vulnerable, and it was particularly vulnerable when it was being targeted by the enemy using IEDs.
And was it, specifically?
Yeah, and I lost friends, you know, in that vehicle and through that role, both you know, regimental ones, but also, you know, sort of mates. A very good friend in the Irish Guards who was company commanding out there was killed. His commanding officer was killed as well, alongside one of our soldiers, through being targeted in that way. And an interesting process. There's a fascinating guy called Lord Drayson, and he was a Labour appointee. It was a Tony Blair appointee to be, I think he was the Minister for Defence Acquisition Change. And Paul Drayson's got a background in biotech, so he's one of life's innovators, both him and his wife, actually. And but he's also a complete petrol head like me, you know, loved his racing. And he took no salary, but came in to look at some of the military procurement acquisition processes, which had delivered some famously rubbish computers over an incredibly long gestation period that were horribly, horribly out of date and ridiculously expensive in a world of disposable laptops. Things took too long to come into service. And he looked at motorsport and said, look, if you are a race team, you race at the weekend and you identify the issue that your not quick enough, that, you know, somebody else has innovated where you haven't. You've got a week or 2 weeks to sort that out, where you need to go away, take the thing apart, innovate, prototype, test, down select to something, manufacture it, get it fitted and deploy it. And you've got to do that in an incredibly short period of time. Otherwise, either you don't make the race or you're last. So how can motorsport do that incredibly agile process, but the military really struggled to do that? And that CADMID cycle that goes through concept, it's an acronym, all the way through to disposal at the other end, you've just got to remove all the middle bits. You've got to bring it together. You've got to be able to do concept and be agile enough to be able to bring something in much quicker. And lots of kit came through on UOR. Lots of stuff then started to come through with these new acquisition processes much quicker. And it saw the guys on the...
Because it was more agile. It was
completely.
A more kind of almost entrepreneurial way of looking at something. There was a problem, you needed to resolve it.
Totally. And if you look at the development of kit on individuals at Afghanistan, you can almost date the tour when you look at photographs that when people were on because of the kit they were wearing, because it was developing so quickly, because of the extras that were attached to rifles, because of innovations in body armor, because of, you know, the fact that all of a sudden everybody was wearing blast pants. That was for a reason. That had come about very quickly. The first major capital project that was delivered into service was Warthog, coming in as a replacement for Viking, directly aimed at Helmand River Valley in order to fulfill that role and in order to allow that fantastic capability, the high mobility, the maneuverability, the ability to lift people, to carry stuff in the back, low ground pressure across the ground, but critically stop the deaths, to help protect those who are inside it and to unlock that potential, but with no luxury to take this thing on trials. And with I was incredibly lucky because I squadron led at the 1st Royal Tank Regiment at doing a CBRN role, and then was brought back to squadron lead at 2RTR. And because I had the, you know, the background in acquisition and doing things with new and novel kit, I was then training up a squadron of guys, both firstly on Viking because we were taking over those vehicles from the guys who'd gone before us, but then also training up on this new thing that was literally coming from the manufacturer. And in less than 2 years, Warthog tracks were on the ground in Afghanistan, and we were doing a relief in place and in contact with D Squadron of the RDGs.
So the trial of it was really in...
It was in Afghanistan.
In Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Well, there was no trial. It was straight in.
Yeah.
And it was tweaking as we went. October 2010, so we finished that trial and you brought it on. October 2010, you was on Herrick 13.
Yeah.
A major, you was... an OC of a squadron, in real layman's terms, just trying to keep it really simple because it's a bit more complex than that. What was the job?
So I was commanding the armoured group. So out in Afghanistan, you have the Commander Task Force Helmand, the Brigadier Satin Lashkargah, commanding officers of ground holding battle groups who then had responsibilities for different pieces of real estate. And there's lots of overlaps with sort of previous guests and, you know, Babaji and Nadi Ali and names of places like this where there were ground holding battle groups. And then there was two independent commands, the BRF, which I think was that Brigade Reconnaissance Force or something like that, but effectively, you know, a task organized bunch of bad guys who were able to, you know, go and exert influence to reinforce, to conduct specific operations, and the armored group. And when it was the Viking group, the armored group had become quite fixed in terms of its role because of its vulnerability. It was just being used to escort combat logistic patrols, which are basically lines of armored vehicles which are making their way of wheeled vehicles, supply vehicles, which were making their way through the green zone doing resupplies.
What's the green zone?
If you sort of look down on the Google maps of that part of Afghanistan, it's all desert with thick green lines running through it, which are alongside the rivers. And the irrigation, which was built by the Americans back in the day, which allowed them to irrigate large areas of land. And it's some of the most fertile land in the world. In amongst what is a, you know, desert all the way around it, and then you've got these river valleys which are incredibly verdant and green, tree lines, ditches, and irrigation channels dotted about through it, and then some sizable rivers, you know, the River Helmand and the Argandab sort of coming in from the other side. And when we went in and took over, we I had two troops, one of whom was supporting an infantry ground-holding unit in Babaji, which is right in the centre of the green zone. The other one was deployed out into the desert in order to go and have a look at some disturbances that were being reported in between Sangin and which by that point had been vacated by the Allies, down to the main highway that runs all the way down to Afghanistan. And you then have this ungoverned space that's full of names of places which have been fought over massively over the last few years, huge opium production in that area, and with that the criminality and the ungoverned elements that kind of sit in behind it. You know, I think somebody referred to before, you know, as, you know, Sangin is a bad place and it's always going to be a bad place. Yeah, that was that
the
was,
centre of evil. It was
yeah, I think that's probably pretty fair. There was a civilian road building company, and I think it was a project that was sponsored by the UAE. Sorry, who was building a road to link up on tarmac to properly link Sangin and then the Kajaki Dam all the way up to Kajaki, to basically bring it into, well, if not the full 20th century, but maybe at least into the 1960s. By connecting it with tarmac. And there's lots of positive influence that would have. This was a strategic project for Afghanistan, the implications being that dam infrastructure, hydroelectricity, could then be reinstated in Kajaki if this road-building project was allowed to continue. And the Taliban were seeing it in a rather different light and were seeing it as an encroachment and bringing governance into their areas, and had rolled back the road some 25 kilometres, wiping out the road teams and their security guys on the way. It was, and they lost a number killed. They lost 80 in one day, with the Taliban just overrunning them.
The road, the people that were building the road, yeah, lost the road, 80 people in one day.
Yeah,
Taliban. Yeah, attacks.
Yeah, and huge amounts of kit, into infrastructure, all of the rest of it, and you know, and the bad guys were, you know, they're pretty good at the intimidation piece. So and it just brought everything to a standstill. You know, they were nearly overrun altogether, so they were fighting from their compound.
So your job then, going out with the Warthog, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
yeah. What was you actually doing there?
We were
finding them.
There wasn't any. There weren't any manned locations up that way at all. There was a big old bit of desert with desert tracks sort of going across it. A lot of traffic going backwards and forwards. The road building crews didn't have the confidence to be able to go out and pick up where they were on the road. And of course, where they'd been rolled out, you know, where they'd been rolled back, the road had been blown up. They'd mined, they'd IED'd, booby-trapped the locations when they were going back out there. And so by providing some security to that, some confidence, it allowed this road-building team to get back out and to start their work again. And they were defending it by, you know, sort of pillbox stuff. So line of sight, building a little fort by the side of the road, and then establishing the next one a little bit further out, all with line of sight. We went a bit more in depth. So we went in order to manoeuvre, in order to disrupt the bad guys and prevent them from being able to exert their influence over the road build. And what started off as a short duration tasking turned into 3 months of living out in the desert. And Warthog came out with some mileage estimates for how far they thought it would travel, based on previous experience of Vikings and based out of Bastion, you know, how much they'd see things doing. And we did what they'd estimated the track mileage for a full tour was in our first 3.5 weeks. Have been deployed into Afghanistan. So yeah, we were out and about a lot. And we basically went out of Bastion and didn't come back in again until the end of the tour.
How many blokes was you responsible for?
Tankies is about 166, I think, was the total sort of who went through that tour. So quite a lot of guys. But then we were task organised. So when that task got reinforced, or when we were doing strike operations in the green zone, you've got a lot of other things which are attached to you. So it sort of fluctuated in size between sort of 350 and at one point was considerably more than that. The Taliban had recognised the significance, particularly of that road build out on the 611 as well. And one of my troop leaders was getting fired at, which was nothing, you know, I mean, this was not a daily occurrence. It was an hourly occurrence, you know, at different times. Was getting fired at, and in an armoured vehicle, you've got a certain amount of confidence against small arms, but he could see this big sort of flash on the horizon that was something different, and had returned fire against it. And he had a GPMG, a general purpose machine gun, in the turret of his vehicle. And the turret of a Warthog is not closed, it's just an open turret. So it's got sides, but it's got no top. So you've got your head and shoulders out to the top with a machine gun. We also had ones that were armed with 50 cals and with a grenade launching thing. But I mean, to be honest, that really didn't get used. The GPMG was just, you know, that was the weapon out there in terms of range and effect, and you could be relatively precise with it because you're always worried about collateral damage. You know, particularly if you're firing towards the green zone, that you always had to really question yourself before you pulled the trigger. Just because you're worried about, you know, what's behind that tree line, you know, are there people? And so he returned fire, and he's got a range of about 1,800 metres, and he could see the shot was falling short of the thing that was firing at him, so he drove towards it, you know, closed the distance between the two. So went up to the sort of next tactical band, so, you know, sort of popped up again, and still firing at him, and he fired back, and his rounds were firing short, and so he did that again and again, until eventually he started to get rounds on the target, and this thing packed up and disappeared pretty pronto. And we did the map recce afterwards, and I remember sort of sitting down with him and going, do you realise that was firing at you from 5.5 kilometres away? So you drove 3 kilometres at this thing while it was firing at you.
What was it?
It was an anti-aircraft gun. So a high-calibre anti-aircraft gun towed thing. You know, this wasn't the thing you fired from your shoulder or anything like that. It was actually a towed, had wheels on the side, you know, sort of anti-aircraft artillery piece that was a high-priced weapon. That was a big thing, you know, for them to have it. And this thing would, you know, punch holes in armour really quite comfortably. And so there was we had Warthogs and Vikings, because we had a mixed fleet originally, as we were bringing these things that were teased out, that had you know, sort of jerry cans shot off the top, you know, and the tops of all of the turrets were all scarred with fire and bits and pieces. I mean, weirdly, with headphones on, you sometimes wouldn't notice small arms fire, and it would be the response, the reaction of people around you. You'd look around and go, why are they all lying down? And then you'd lift your headset off a little bit, and you go, oh yeah, no, someone's firing at
it. Was you getting many casualties? Because you're responsible for these.
Yeah, and I really felt that quite sharply. I was determined to lead from the front. I was famous in my ops room for never being there. I had a magnificent 2IC who held the ground back there, because there's all sorts of stuff that you still need to do despite the fact that, you know, there's a war going on outside, in terms of writing reports and doing various bits and pieces. And I had a fantastic ops room staff who helped to make that happen, to allow me to do it. And I did a lot from the vehicle out in, helped by technology, out in the back end of nowhere. But I sort of very much led from the front, because I had this unshakable self-belief, really, in that I knew that the best defence against IEDs was don't run over them. You know, so you can talk about innovations in armour as much as you like, but the best way to deal with a blast is don't set it off. And so we innovated. We drove everywhere where they weren't expecting us to be. We didn't stay in the same place two nights in a row. It was, you know, wagons in a circle. You know, sort of, you used a Wild West analogy. We were putting in the wagons in a circle, and not setting patterns, getting resupplied from the air. You know, we had C-130 air dropping stuff into us, you know, at night time, you've got a plane coming out, you know, dropping water, fuel, rations, ammunition out of the back to us in a desert leaguer out in the back end of nowhere. And we operated independently and from there for months on end. And I bounced in between the troop that was out there permanently and the guys in the green zone. So you've got one troop who've got engagement distances of 5.5 kilometres where they're driving towards, you know, prized high caliber weapons. And then you've got another troop that's operating in the green zone where the average engagement distance is, you know, 25 to 150 metres, you know, across
within
a field.
To the enemy.
Yeah, you know, guys climbing.
So
up
the area was full of risk, and it was diverse with the kind of conflict that was going on.
Yeah, and the IED risk is just there all the time. That was the enemy's chief way of targeting you. They would lay in the tracks of the vehicles, so they would come out and lay immediately behind you. And if you returned on that same route, you know, despite the fact you'd think it was safe, you'd be following your own tracks, they would they'd have laid in the tracks. They'd actually, we would have to, if you had a track which was broken, we would have to destroy it, because we'd seen a pattern where they had some, and they did it with Viking. They had a section of Viking track which they would use to go over the top of where they'd laid the IED so that it looked a continuous route. And so you wouldn't normally drive alongside another set of tracks. We had the freedom to do so in the desert. You'd be alongside, perhaps sort of 10 feet to the side. And so then we saw them do that, laying IEDs off track, anticipating that you would drive off the tracks. You'd sort of drive on main routes as well, but then they would be trying to use things remotely, where things were remotely triggered. Because they're bright people and they're innovating in order to look at how can they kind of target you. And we saw some quite complex IEDs as well, where they had triggers where it could only be set off by a Warthog or a Viking, in that if a car passed over it, it would close one loop and then it would close the other loop. But a vehicle that was long enough and could depress both of them at the same time would initiate the IED. And that's deliberately targeting, you know, that's sort of deliberately targeting our stuff. And they would lay in all of the places which they knew offered a good view down into the things that they were trying to keep secret. So where you were looking for observation positions to look down into the edge of the green zone, when we were following up on comms intercepts in order to look at where the bad guys, you know, where you know they are, they would have chains of IEDs laid out and use unarmed guys with radio sets and mobile phones on motorbikes, dickers, to swarm around and report on your position. And so we played them at their own game, you know. So I blew up a troop leader. We staged an IED. We used a DEM set in order to have a bunch of vehicles that went alongside the green zone and then drove off the vehicle at the back, which set off a bit slowly, blew itself up, and the other ones drove off, leaving it behind. And it was one of our troop leaders with a DEMS kit, and left him. And then watched the bad guys then...
Was bit?
Yeah, yeah. And then watched the bad guys then swarm in order to be able to come... The motorbikes coming out, the comms intercepts talking about people, senior Taliban commanders coming out, talking about taking this thing as a prize, and then, absolutely as bait in order to then snot people in the right places. And using layers of technology in order to be able to help us to do it. So you'd set a trap for these guys. And then you could literally then roll back through comms intercepts, you could roll back through high definition video, you could roll back through satellite cover in order to see who's made which telephone call where. And then you trace, you can pinpoint the individual and then watch where he's come from. And that way you find the weapons caches, you find who's where, you find how their comms things work, and you start targeting the bad guys.
It was like not cat and mouse, it was just like it was going to out trump each other in many ways.
Yeah.
I asked you a question, was the casualties?
Yeah. We suffered on that tour. I was incredibly fortunate because I brought everybody home. We weren't expecting that. Just from prior experience and handing over, that was one of the hardest things I've ever done. I really kind of struggled with that. And a guy was blown up within 6 days of us leaving. One of the guys had taken over from us and was killed. But we did suffer casualties. I think had we... had the IEDs, the RPGs, So rocket-propelled grenade attacks, and being on Viking, I would have probably gone to at least five funerals.
Mm.
But as it was, we had guys who survived, and you know that was incredible. It's incredibly difficult though when you lose them, because you lose them from you, and you've lost a member of the family. It's a bereavement they're taken away from you. And you're just hurting. You're desperate for information on, you know, how they're going, and you really don't hear that much. You know, it's quite.
Was it pressure for you?
I quite acutely felt that. We had a very intensive period of scrapping before Christmas, and my wife was heavily pregnant with my second, so Holly, my daughter, and I was ordered back. I went back happily, you know, for my daughter's birth, which was sort of around New Year. But spent a lot of time at what Celia could become, so Queen Elizabeth's Hospital, because in my absence we had a couple of vehicles that had been targeted, and you've got lads coming back with casualties, including amputees, including traumatic brain injuries. And so yeah, my R&R. My R&R was pretty rubbish. You know, you've got young lads coming back, and they, you know, the boys are brilliant. They've innovated. They've gone skiing. You know, they've been on a beach somewhere magnificent. Mm. And I'd gone home and spent all my time in hospital, sort of casualty visiting, and then, you know, or my wife squeezing the living daylights out of my hand. It wasn't much fun. I couldn't wait to get back to Afghanistan. That feels quite strange. You know, come back for something which is wonderful, you know, the sort of birth of my daughter, but I just could not wait to get back. Because I need to get back to the boys.
Mm.
That was.
And it's the it's those troops around you that's kind of led you on to your next thing, really. And we'll skip some of the detail in between you leaving, but needless to say, you left. You set Mission Motorsport up in 2012. What is it?
I've got a bit of a weird background as an army officer, in that I've always raced, and the army never considered motorsport to be a sport until 2009. So all of the racing which I'd sort of managed to do, I'd done despite the best efforts of the military. And I'd also written about it. So I had a number of friends through media and things like that, because I used to do bits and pieces for Piston Heads and some of the magazines like Evo. Which allowed me to you know, have access to sort of cars and racing and things like that otherwise I wouldn't have. But I'd always use those motorsport connections within a military context to raise money, whether that was running track days on military real estate, or whether it was auctioning off, you know, a trip to the tank museum and, you know, climbing on a tank to a motorsport audience to raise a bit of cash for service charities, whether it was the Benevolent Funds or Royal British Legion or Help for Heroes when that emerged. But in 2010, 2011, I think a couple of things had changed. I had a number of offers which were up my sleeve that I could have used in order to raise money, you know, when I came back, and that was kind of what I was aiming to do. But I had an audience of blokes who I really wanted to help, and to get them off the sofa and to turn lights back on where... You know, I sort of came back in May. We reunited with a lot of the guys actually in Cyprus on decompression. My unit had been fantastic and got a lot of the walking wounded. I mean, some of whom were, you know, on prosthetics.
Mm.
And flew them out to Cyprus to meet us as we came back through that 24-hour decompression period, which was incredible. It was incredibly emotional as well. And I thought some of these things which would disappear into... would raise a couple of grand for charity coffers. Actually, we had blokes who would love to do that. And so we took them racing. And it was really successful. And when you start getting guys offered jobs, guys who are leaving the military...
But
guys,
what does it do? I don't quite understand. What does it actually do, the charity?
Well, we...
Does it rehabilitate?
Yeah. I mean, at that time, you know, this was just volunteer stuff.
Yeah.
Doing a bit of... recovery sport in order to get people up off the sofa and engaged.
Okay,
and for all the reasons why sport is amazing, you know, it's restorative, it's healing. Motorsport is extraordinary for the disabled because there's no separate category. You don't do a different sort of sport. You adapt the vehicle instead. and they can play on a level playing field against the able-bodied, and that's incredibly powerful. That's a cool thing to do. Becoming 17 is an enormous thing in many people's lives, because that's the point at which you get independence and freedom through being able to have your driving license. And driving and vehicle-related trades are the largest trade group in all three services. It's the most common thing that people leave the military with. And being able to celebrate those freedoms around that, being able to help somebody to use that, to give them a reason to get out of bed in the morning, but ultimately to help connect them to a career that allows them to provide for their families in the future. That's the ultimate goal. And I raged at MOD for where I saw MOD having a duty of care that they were falling short of. Because you know, they didn't understand it. And you've got some fantastic things that were being done with great philanthropic intent, but that weren't necessarily being professionally delivered. And you run the risk of causing more harm than doing good. And particularly some of the shiny things. If you're aiming at an Everest of sport, it's easy to lose sight on the reason why you're attempting Everest. And the reason why you would aim for that has to be to meet the recovery goals of the individuals who are taking place. And some of these intoxicating, fantastic, exciting things were instead being used to consume some of these people who are at their most vulnerable. And of course they want to do it. Of course they want to lean into it. But when you've got double amputees finding themselves back in Queen Elizabeth's Hospital, getting extra bits sawn off them as a result of an infection which they've received because they were in a Welsh Valley hill rallying because they want to be able to go and do the Dakar in the longer term, you're not actually helping them. If they're doing it and they're not on duty, then they're not covered by the Armed Forces Compensation Scheme. But if you're doing it such that, you know, they're having to have surgery in order to, you're not just setting back the timing of their recovery, you're potentially setting back the degree to which they can recover.
So it's not about the like you said, that shiny thing. It's not about the actual race.
No.
It's about how we can support somebody rehabilitate and give that long term recovery through sport. Like the Invictus is doing, but it's not about the thing.
Yeah.
It's about the individual and their long term well being.
Absolutely. And Invictus is an incredible example of that. But it has to be, and when it's absolutely at its best, the stories that you absolutely love is where people are talking about what an incredible experience they had at the Invictus Games, and you go, well, absolutely, that's great, and they were there on a pedestal having an amazing time. But it's the fact that the Invictus Games has changed their life on a longer basis, and they're now participating in sport, they're a member of their local sporting club, they perceive themselves differently, and they're no longer talking about themselves in you know, you go and ask people, what do you mate? And you say, oh no, I was, pointing at a leg or a limb or a scar on a forehead, and say, you know, I was blown up in wherever doing this, that, and the other. And you're like, no, I didn't ask what you were. I said, what are you? And where people are starting to define themselves in the here and now and in looking forward, being positive, talking about what they do and what they contribute now, that's a huge cognitive step. And it's indicative of a much wider recovery. All sports can help set people on that path. And for the military amongst you, you know, it's putting people back in team situations. It's putting them amongst their peers. It's putting a Union Jack back on their, you know, on their left shoulder, helping them to represent and to be proud of what they are. But in automotive, there's just these extraordinary opportunities, because behind motorsport is an automotive industry that has been going through incredible growth over the last few years. I mean, it's £82 billion worth of UK turnover. You know, the UK automotive industry is 12.5% of UK net export. This is big stuff. And they need quality people within it in order to make them thrive. And, you know, using that Invictus example, you know, Jaguar Land Rover on the back of the first Invictus Games did something incredible by supporting something that nobody ever knew whether it would work. and supported Prince Harry's vision of doing these games, but had done something more fundamental, I think, that year, which was they'd signed the Armed Forces Covenant, and with top down direction from the very top, had said, you know, we are going to help this population of people who are leaving the army, whether it's wounded, injured, sick, or whether it's service leavers and veterans generally, and we've helped them on that path. And to date, since the first Invictus Games, Jaguar Land Rover have hired, given new careers to, more than 930 veterans since September 2014.
And have you been part of that?
Yeah, so we've helped, a little bit in the delivery of those first Invictus Games, and we helped Jaguar Land Rover run their Armed Forces Engagement Scheme, which has removed a lot of the barriers which are in place for service leavers. We as a community are not good at writing CVs. We don't think about things in terms of personal achievement. We think about team stuff. I mean, from that Afghanistan tour, I was mentioned in dispatches, and that was something that made me quite acutely uncomfortable at the time. Because at no point when I was manoeuvring around the place, regardless of, you know, personal jeopardy, I had a crew on board. So yeah, I was leading from the front, but you know, I wasn't on a motorbike. I was part of an armoured formation. We struggle to talk about individual achievement. We instead talk about what teams have done, what those goals have been achieved. And we, all of our career progression is based on what others write about us, not on what we write about ourselves. There is no point in a military career where you sit down and you big yourself up. It feels weird and horrible and wrong to do so. Mm. But that's exactly what you need to be able to do in order for an HR professional to pick up on those things. But if you're screening people out using some crude tools such as degree, if somebody has a degree, then, you know, doesn't have a degree, they're not considered. If they don't have prior industry experience, they're not considered. It might mean that the CV is never getting read by a human being. Mm. And if it is read by a human being, it's read by an HR professional who doesn't understand the terminology that we all speak in, because we all speak in acronyms and about bits and pieces. We don't talk in the same terminology as them. And chances are we've probably applied for the wrong job, because they also talk in a different language, which is one that we don't understand, and a level 4 emissions test engineer supervisor, you know, I don't know whether that's a lance corporal or a brigadier's job, so
yeah,
the chances of me knowing whether it's right for me is quite limited. So we help with them with the articulation of how they do things. We've removed a lot of barriers. We now do it for a whole bunch of other people. We help DHL supply chain, Honda, the UK manufacturing, and a whole host of exciting smaller companies. We've got guys in Formula One, we've got guys in Formula E, and we've got blokes who've used that experience to become a plumber so that they can settle in the part of the country that's right for them, and their kids can go to the school that that suits them. I'm not bothered what people end up doing. You always tend to focus on the really shiny end of the stuff.
But the because I think it's great, the rehabilitation is that shiny thing.
Yeah.
But the recovery is what your main focus is, and it's about that long-term meaningful employment.
And it's about a personal journey, not just for them, but with their families as well.
Yeah.
That's incredibly important. A lot of our work is focused on exactly that. We spend very little time actually having to worry about physical rehabilitation, and we're not experts in it at all. But we've never struggled to get an amputee up a flight of stairs, you know, or into, you know, somewhere that's difficult. We have not found a vehicle that we cannot adapt in order to allow, you know, triple amputees to be able to operate them. That's just engineering. We probably spend 80% of our time with issues of mental health, and whether that's PTSD or much, much broader than that. We find a disassociation of people struggling to find their place within their new context and struggling with that transition from...
But it's understanding that it can all be linked. It's not just one. It can't be pigeonholed. There's a plethora of issues that can be faced, especially when people can't find employment or they've got difficulties or confidence issues, or often people look back and they think, look, I used to be able to do this, and now I can't do that. And I think this is a great example of being able to go on a level playing field initially, and then actually pushing on into industry and going, well, I'm still on a level playing field. If not, I'm adding more value because I've been able to highlight the value I actually have, whether it's working in high voltage or whether it's articulating experiences and leadership skills from Afghanistan and Iraq and Bosnia or whatever.
Yeah.
It's being able to articulate that and having someone there to almost hold your hand initially to kind of give you that confidence to move forward.
And there are no jobs in Civvy Street driving tanks, but there are so many jobs for tank drivers.
Yeah,
it's just none of them are crewing Challenger 2.
How can people get involved with you on a kind of veteran basis?
We're pretty easy to find. Google Works, stick Mission Motorsport in, and we're all over it. The website has got links on it, emails, but social media as well. Through Facebook, Twitter, you can kind of see what we're up to. It's the support of the big service charities that allowed us to get where we are. Help for Heroes, you're there from the beginning, just doing extraordinary stuff. And the Royal British Legion, with some of our veterans programs, Walking with the Wounded, with some of the educational pieces that we've been doing. And the Royal Foundation, just helping out a huge amount with the networking and the confidence, really, that brings. We're really excited. We're in an exciting time at the moment because I think UK automotive is in a fascinating place because there's a revolution happening which is around electrification. It's driven by a need to go to lower emission vehicles, and that means that EVs and plug-in hybrids and things where there's capacitance on board a vehicle and an electrical motor involved somewhere. Is bringing a whole new range of vehicles onto the market, and we're suddenly not thinking about electric vehicles, about range anxiety and milk floats. You're thinking about Teslas and exciting stuff. And as the prices come down and incentives go up in order to allow that to happen, there's a tipping point, and this provides just the most incredible opportunities, from manufacturing through looking after vehicles, through servicing, through MOTing, through the emergency services that respond to things on the side of the road, where you go rushing into that vehicle that's on fire, whether somebody in there, do you go and touch the door handle or do you think about isolating it first? These are skills in high voltage stuff, which it's not complicated, but it doesn't exist at the moment in UK automotive. And over the next few years, there are going to be so many fantastic opportunities that come that will allow people to get across that. And we've looked back, and in 6 years of work, we put 130 wounded, injured and sick guys into employment in the automotive sector. But by working with big companies, you've over 1,700 veterans into jobs.
That's amazing.
But I think that's the tip of the iceberg. And, with the help of the Royal Foundation and some of the big industry groups like Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders, we're launching a new initiative which will open the doors for an entire new generation of both service leavers and veterans, guys who are out there who don't realise that the training which they received when they're in the military actually gives them skill sets, behaviours and qualifications which are recognised and valued and desperately needed by industry to meet this new thing.
I think that backs up what Jordan Wiley talks about on episode 9, and I'd kind of like prompt people, especially service leavers and veterans, to go and listen to that one as well. And you guys are doing some unbelievable stuff. It's missionmotorsport.org, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Go check it out. I'll put all the notes on Twitter and Facebook and whatnot. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's been fascinating. James, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
And we'll leave it there.